From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Supporters of Bernie Sanders apparently haven't lost any of their enthusiasm after all five of Tuesday's primaries went to Hillary Clinton, although the results were closer than predicted, and Sanders came very close to taking Illinois and Missouri. The Vermont senator himself gave no sign of an intent to pull out quite yet.
Phoenix, are you ready for a political revolution?
Although Clinton has won far more states than Sanders, the delegate count isn't that far apart. After voters in those five states, Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, and Ohio, cast their ballots Tuesday, Clinton saw her count reach 58.6% of the elected delegates, or 1,094 out of the required total of 2,383, while Sanders has thus far earned 41.4% with 774 delegates. On the Republican side, Senator Marco Rubio dropped out after losing his home state of Florida to Donald Trump, while Ohio Governor John Kasich moved up after his home state victory, the only loss that Trump suffered. Trump swept four of the five contests Tuesday and has more than half of the delegates required for nomination on the first ballot at the Republican National Convention. The negotiating team representing the U.S.-backed forces in Syria met with the U.N.'s High Commissioner, Stéphane de Mistura, in Geneva Tuesday in the second round of talks aimed at ending what is now 5 years of war in the country. This was Basma Kodmani, a spokesperson for the Saudi-backed group called the High Negotiating Committee, discussing rumors of a proposed 8-point peace plan from the Syrian government at a press conference after the session.
We look forward to hearing from Mr. de Mistura in the following sessions more precisely what is in that proposal from the regime. We would like to see what the regime has to offer, because this is the whole point for us. And as I said, we are prepared and have already started saying that we will provide details. We will provide detailed documents on each and every issue that is raised, and particularly on the transitional governing body as we see it and how it should operate, what its prerogatives should be, and the mode of operation. So we will go into these details. We hope those details will become clear also from the regime's side. This will be the substance of the negotiation.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin Monday ordered the withdrawal of his country's forces from Syria, and there were reports from Russian media that the withdrawal had begun Tuesday.
In a short period of time, Russia created a small but very effective military group in Syria. The effective work of our military forces allowed the peace process to begin. I think the task of Russia's defense ministry and the Russian troops is in general complete.
Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, said his forces' work had been completed.
With the airstrikes, we managed to reduce and in some areas to completely cut off the supply lines of the terrorists' trade in hydrocarbons. The main routes of the trade with Turkey have been cut off, as well as the main routes which provided the terrorists with weapons.
Russia will continue to maintain its permanent naval base at Tartus and its permanent air base in Latakia. RT's Lizzie Phelan is in Syria, and she filed this report.
Prior to Russia launching its air campaign, there was absolutely no question in most of the opposition's minds about negotiating with the Syrian government. However, almost on a daily basis, reconciliation deals are being reached with many of the factions and the Syrian government. You have to bear in mind that there's hundreds, if not more than 1,000, different factions amongst the opposition in Syria. So this has been a hugely significant development.
Under the framework agreement reached, de Mistura was set to meet with the opposition delegation Tuesday and then again with the government delegation Wednesday. After Russia surprised the world with its withdrawal announcement, some hard negotiating began in earnest in Geneva. Colonel Mohammed Al-Ahmad, a spokesperson for the Shami Front, one of the largest anti-government groups in Syria, said there are critical steps remaining before a long-term peace deal can be reached. CCTV's McCall Bardavid filed this report from the Turkish border town of Kilis.
After 5 years of war in Syria and UN-mediated peace talks resuming in Geneva, Putin's announcement to withdraw forces from Syria has triggered some hope. This former pilot of the Syrian army, who first defected to become a rebel commander and then became a spokesman for the Jabhat al-Shamia front, believes it can all end with global support.
The future is unpredictable, but if the international community wants to stop this tragedy, they can stop the tragedy very easily.
For rebel forces, the cessation of hostilities and the release of prisoners are critical for peace. There are several other critical conditions that need to be met in order for an agreeable political solution to be reached.
Watching Syrian people spread across the whole world and the refugees who are living at the Syrian-Turkish border, some of them living in tents and others in the fields, this is pain.
It is no doubt that after years of war and with many at the negotiation table, the ones who are suffering the most continue to be the Syrians themselves. Michal Bardavid, CCTV, at the Turkish-Syrian border.
The playing field looks a bit different after Tuesday's primaries in five states. To survey the landscape, we spoke with Professor Anthony Montero, activist and author, from Philadelphia via Skype Wednesday morning.
I think Sanders is doing extraordinarily well. The movement that he is at the head of is showing itself to be resilient, showing itself to be really a movement that has entered into a rigged democratic primary electoral process, but it is a movement that will go beyond whatever happens in the primaries and whatever happens in the general election. Sanders calls it a political revolution. I tend to agree with him that what the people that he represents are demanding are real radical changes in the ways the country is governed and the way that the economy works. So I'd like to just congratulate the Bernie Sanders movement.
You know, and let's unpack that a little bit, a couple of things that are in there. Number one, the relationship of Sanders to this movement. In other words, is it something being conducted by Sanders, or is there this movement that once somebody threw a little meat out into the arena formed around it and is now pushing forward? And then in terms of the nature of this phenomenon of his, you know, success electorally so far, how that all mechanically has developed?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to your first question, I think it's both and. It's both Sanders, but increasingly it is the people. And that's to Sanders' credit. He has not tried to put blinders or to control his movement. He's completely honest about what he is, what he stands for, and that's a good thing. But I think the movement is deeper than Sanders and goes beyond Sanders. Let me give you an example. You know, in a lot of ways, it is a movement that joins the young generation with older workers who have been downsized and lost their jobs and lost their incomes and lost their homes and other things as a result of these corporate trade deals that everybody from Clinton up to Obama have made. They've gone against the American working class. So you have these two groups coming together. But on the side of the millennials, it's now clear that two-thirds of them identify themselves as pro-socialist, and 9% of that two-thirds consider themselves communist. Whoa. So, you know, you get this very radical movement. More than that, a study just came out showing that more than half of the millennials identify themselves as working class, even if they have a degree from a university or don't have a degree or don't have a high school education. This increasing identification as workers reflects a growing consciousness. So I think all of this is feeding the Bernie Sanders rebellion, or what he likes to call political revolution.
Okay, so you've got Rubio out. You've got Cruz looking at Kasich, not so far behind him in a few of these contests, and Kasich, of course, winning in his own state. Not a big surprise, but you know, it was the only thing that stopped Trump last night. And then you have the relative delegate split is about 58-42 or so between Clinton and Sanders as far as the elected delegates go, and Clinton still has less than half of the delegates that she needs. What's going to happen next? Like, how does this unfold going forward?
Well, you know, you mentioned Trump, and again, you're looking at a movement where some of the same issues that are driving the Bernie Sanders movement are in the Trump movement. For example, fair trade as against free trade. The other side of it is the ways that parties, and in this instance for Trump, the Republican Party, chooses its candidates and its leaders, et cetera. So, you know, on the right, you got this movement, which is really a majority, it seems, working class movement. One study showed that if you want to predict who's voting for Bernie Sanders, what you need to do is look at that group of people whose life expectancies have declined over the last 15 years. And you're talking about white, middle-aged, mainly men who have a high school education or less. So the country is in a rebellious moment. I think this is going to be the angriest election in recent history. And I think the anger at the political establishment goes way beyond anything we saw in 1968. So it's hard to predict. I mean, Hillary Clinton does not have the nomination. I think Trump is closer to the nomination than Clinton is. But Clinton, if we are to be clear about it, is really Wall Street's, and in particular, Goldman Sachs' candidate. And they're doing everything they can, including stealing elections, which I suspect happened in Chicago, certainly in Massachusetts and Iowa, just rigging the process. But she's Wall Street's candidate, and they're going all out to elect her to make her the nominee of the Democratic Party, and also to make her the next president. But I think the people are going to have a lot to say about that between now and the conventions.
Well, okay, now you have, let's say, in terms of the two faces, perhaps, of a mass movement or certainly discontent, the relationship between Sanders and the people that are behind him, the part of the movement that's behind him, and the relationship between Trump and the movement that's behind him, they share, in a way, the fact that they're being tugged from the bottom or led from the bottom to a degree. But the nature of the relationship is different because Trump, of course, has all the tools of Madison Avenue to tailor the feedback in that relationship. And in addition, there's a class character that's different in terms of the ideology, the organizing principles. On the one hand, working class rhetoric, maybe FDR-ish, social democrat, whatever, on Sanders' side, and literally, at least nationalistic, if not fascistic, country above class on the other. How do you
I mean, you're engaged in the battle for the workers and others that are inside Trump's camp or inside Sanders, because Trump's going for them. How do you win that battle from Sanders' perspective?
Well, I think Sanders just keeps doing what he's doing. And I think, you know, it's interesting and almost ironic that in some ways these two movements are playing off of each other. You know, case in point is Ohio, where to stop Trump, many of Bernie's possible voters, especially independents and some Republican voters, voted for Kasich, including Democrats that may have voted for Bernie in order to stop Trump. But the two movements cannot be tone deaf to positions of the other. I think that the Trump movement is far angrier, and the form that it takes, at least as we receive it through the mass media, and the mass media is not an accurate lens, believe me, you have to take into account where the people in the Trump movement started. They start from the Republican Party. They start from having been brought into this party behind the race before class mantra, going back to Wallace and Nixon's Southern strategy up to the Reagan Revolution. That's where they start. But what it is a movement of people betrayed by, and I put quotes, their leaders. And they want to bring, and again quotes, their leaders down. And in that respect, the Trump movement is far more dangerous to the politics of the country than the Sanders movement is at this point, because it is an all-out assault upon the leaders of the Republican Party. And the Trump movement has the potentiality of really destroying or bringing down the Republican Party. Its intent in many ways is to do that. That is not the same with the Sanders movement. I think from the standpoint of the left, as I've said before, we have to dig in. We have to get closer and closer to the working class, even when parts of it express ideas and views we don't accept. And even when they do things that we don't like, we have to get closer and understand what is motivating them. And believe me, for the first time in maybe 80 years, we are hearing the voices of misery and suffering coming from the white working class, the white poor, and even the white lumpen proletariat.
You know, just speculating, if they take the nomination away from Trump or someone, you know, legitimately beats him on the one hand, and if Clinton wins on another, I'm going to propose this scenario only because it's the most plausible one from the point of view of ballot status, because it's March, and if you were going to run third-party campaigns, you can't get on the ballot in some states already. Mm-hmm. Suppose Sanders turned on his word, you know, and I don't give much of a possibility of this happening, but suppose Sanders and Trump both broke and ran third-party candidacy. Say Sanders, as Jill Stein, steps aside and Sanders becomes the Green Party candidate, however that works, and Trump right. does whatever he's got to do, libertarians, or sets up the Trump label and buys a few election commissions to get in late, whatever. You have now a four-way race. Well, mm-hmm. how does that play out if that happened?
See, I think a more realistic possibility is mass organization. I think on the Sanders side, he is already forcing real struggles within the unions, where the rank and file are going with Bernie Sanders in many instances, and the leaders have already endorsed Clinton. That is a huge split within the trade union movement, and it's a split that we have been hoping for and trying to encourage for decades, that such a split could mean a new leadership emerging within separate unions and hopefully eventually at the level of the AFL-CIO itself. Now, that's the Sanders side. But at the same time, on the Trump side, this kind of uprising of formerly right-wing, politically associated working-class people means that the possibility of these two movements finding points of unity, especially on economic issues, which are the same as class issues. I mean, this is huge, and I don't think we have seen anything comparable to this in 80 years, and maybe at the height of the Great Depression, nothing comparable to this, because if you take the period of the Depression, the working class movement was in its infancy in terms of organizing industrial unions and that type of thing. They were not talking about bringing down the political elites of each of the parties. I think to quell the rebellion, the ruling class would do itself a favor and get behind Sanders as the new FDR. What a Clinton or even a Trump presidency will do will only infuriate the masses of working people and lower middle class people even more, thus intensifying this movement of working people.
And particularly in each case, Hillary Clinton, just by being president, regardless of what policies she does, is going to inflame a huge part of the population, mostly Republicans, but a lot of Democrats. And likewise for Trump, there'll be almost every Democrat in the country, and about half the Republicans will be inflamed just by his presence in the White House.
But see, rather than... See, I'm not even concerned in the first instance with what officials in either party are thinking.
Right.
My focus is upon what the ordinary people who are making both of these movements are thinking and how they will view what will happen. You know, look, take the Republicans. I mean, they were talking last week and a half ago, about a Stop Trump movement. Now they're reconsidering this, knowing that if Trump comes to the Republican convention in Cleveland with maybe not enough delegates to win the nomination on the first ballot, but the majority, and having won these large states like Illinois and Florida and on and on and on, and they deny him the nomination, they're facing a real uprising right at the convention itself, and even a violent one.
Right.
You know, I think that that on the Sanders side, he is trying to appeal to reason. And he is saying to all sides, including the ruling class, that your best bet is with him. One, he seems to do better in polls against Trump. But on the other side, the policies that he represents could, if implemented, or at least if people see him as president fighting for them, could kind of weaken the legitimacy crisis that the ruling class faces at this time. I just see Wall Street, as relates to Hillary Clinton and whoever is behind Trump, and that's a mixed bag of the ruling class, some Wall Street, but not all Wall Street, not as much Wall Street as Clinton. I think all sides have to realize that in terms of the people's movement, we have crossed the Rubicon. It starts out, let us say, with the movement against police brutality and terroristic murders of black people, which ultimately became the Black Lives Matter movement. But now it is resituating in the working class, and the Black Lives Matter is coming into that or is connected to that. But a big part of all of this is the young generation, in particular the millennials, who have no future if things continue the way they are.
You know, taking more stock in what the people in the street are thinking over the political leaders, quote unquote, certainly points to the need to understand them in order to organize them around individual or certain principles and trying to find common ground between the blocks. What should organizers be looking at in addition to identifying what people are thinking in terms of presenting it to them and learning to work with other organizers who may be, you know, the holders of some very, you know, contrary views, to put it gently?
Well, I think, you know, we have entered a period which might be new for a lot of people in the left, and that is a moment of realpolitik within the movements. You know, the left is more has greater expertise in you know, analysis and slogans and marches, but when it comes to these issues of politics within movements, of creating united fronts, coalitions, rainbow coalitions, and all kinds of other unities among the people, where you have to give and take, where you have to listen, where you have to work with people who you might not be comfortable with. You know, for example, a poor white person from West Virginia who doesn't talk like you, doesn't think culturally like you, but has economic interest and even political points of view that have to be taken seriously. I think that's where we're going from the standpoint of the left. The left has to grow up in this period, has to mature in a period of rebellion and opposition coming from the working class itself.
And now, a final telephone call made by Wopatishwe Mondo Ayan Wilanga, formerly known as David Rice, who died in prison last Friday. He had been a political prisoner in the Nebraska State Penitentiary since 1971, when he and fellow Black Panther Ed Poindexter were serving life sentences after conviction for the murder of an Omaha policeman. Both men have denied any connection with the crime, and even Amnesty International called for either a new trial or his immediate release.
I had seen the new documentary of Black Panther Party, Vanguard of the Revolution, and it was really pretty good. I was, of course, not surprised, but disappointed that there was no mention that I caught of the Midwest chapters, namely Omaha, Des Moines, Iowa, and Kansas City, Missouri. And this is not atypical. Most of the books, the documentaries and so forth that we see or read in the Black Panther Party do seem to ignore the existence of the Midwest chapters, almost as if we not only did not function, were not relevant, but did not even exist. Fortunately, there is an article that just came out a couple of weeks ago. It's on BuzzFeed, called The Forgotten Panthers, which does talk at least about my and Ed's case.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.